Welcome to Nights, Nicola.
Thank you, Brian.
Is that how you memorise the periodic table?
No, not at all. He doesn't have it in any particular order, just how it sings best, I think.
Yes, so it's the art first,
yes,
then
absolutely.
The science, which
absolutely.
Isn't so useful for a scientist.
Oh, it's still quite fun.
Yeah, it is. You, like our physicist, Sean Hendy, you work for the McDiarmid Institute for Advanced Materials and Nanotechnology.
That I do, yeah.
And it's International Chemistry Year, and my first question to you really was, well, why does something so elementary, if you forgive the pun, need its own year?
Oh, first, it's a very good pun. Secondly, I suppose a lot of topics get a year from UNESCO in recognition of the fact that they are important things that need to be celebrated. We had the year of physics not so long ago, and chemistry, it was time, I suppose. There is also the fact that Marie Curie won her Nobel Prize in chemistry 100 years ago, and that's quite
All
a significant
right.
event. Yeah.
And the lecture series, which is a big part of celebration of the chemistry year in New Zealand, is named after her, the Marie Curie lecture series. Kiwi women chemists talking about their topic, their field of study up and down the country. Now, I think I said it was beginning this week, but I was slightly wrong. It's already started, hasn't
it? It's already
it?
Started. It was scheduled to be the same week that we were originally scheduled to talk, which is where you possibly got that from. That was Margaret Brimble, who came down from Auckland to talk here in Wellington at Te Papa about her particular topic of interest, which is medicinal chemistry. I went along. It was fabulous, fabulous talk. And the next one's Bridget Stocker, who's from here in Wellington, and she's going up to New Plymouth, I believe. So it's all about getting people out across the country to talk about the sorts of chemistry they do and communicate that with the public.
And you're one of the speakers too.
Yes, but a little bit later in the year.
What will you be talking about?
I'll be talking about the discovery of new elements a little bit and my own particular research area, which is quantum chemistry or theoretical chemistry.
Are all the elements that are out there discovered now? Is there anything, theoretically, could we make more elements?
Theoretically, absolutely yes, and there are experiments underway to do that. So since Tom Lehrer sang his song, there are a few more elements that have been discovered.
His song could have been longer.
His song could well have been longer. Some of the elements have rather difficult names, such as element 108, which is unin octium, I believe. And some of them, such as element 112, have been given new names. That's recently been called copernicium, and that's the most recent addition to the periodic table.
Some of those elements would be unstable, but if they're on the right part of the table, they could be inherently stable elements.
Well,
is that possible?
There is a prediction which dates back a little while now that at a certain number of protons and neutrons, there's something called the island of stability, where elements would start to become more stable again. So you go through all this series of radioactive elements, started with polonium, which was discovered by Marie Curie, and you go through to element 112 now, and there's some sign of promise in that element 112 has a longer half-life, so it hangs about, it takes a little bit longer to decay than a lot of the other radioactive elements nearing it, and so there is some hope that maybe more stable elements will be produced. But having said that, of course, it costs roughly $1 million to produce a single atom of one of these substances, so you can't imagine that they'll be useful for very much in the short term.
That's a lot of money.
Yes.
I mean, if you extrapolated that out to a gram,
yes,
it would be New Zealand's, well, probably more than New Zealand's GDP.
Yes,
probably
don't ask
be
me
China's.
To do maths right now.
Marie Curie, which is the woman the lecture series is named after. Now, she was the first scientist to discover, isolate radioactive elements. Is that right?
Yes. Well, people knew about uranium beforehand, and X-rays had been discovered, and Becquerel had been working with radioactive materials. And what she did was she took a sample of essentially uranium oxide or an ore that contained that, and by separating out the uranium component chemically, she was able to show that there was something left over that still was radioactive. And she had the insight that this meant that it was an atomic property, and that therefore the atoms in this material must be different and must be new and unknown to science. And so simply on that basis of the radioactivity of this material that was not uranium, she said, well, there must be a new element. And then she actually separated that into two components, and so was able to say, well, the one component is polonium and the other is radium. And she was right.
Radium is the name I most associate with her.
Mm.
But what is it about those elements when you get further down the periodic table in terms of numbers? Why are they radioactive?
Well, the nuclei of all our chemical elements are held together by forces which bind the protons and neutrons together. And as you go up in proton number, so atomic number, you need more neutrons to hold the nucleus together. And at some point, this fails to overcome the inherent repulsion of the protons, you know, positive charges that repel each other. So at some point, this just, it fails to hold together. And that's the limits of the periodic table of stable elements, which is around bismuth, so 80-something protons. But as you go past that, of course, you can get nuclei that can be produced and that hang around for a certain amount of time, so uranium and other things. And then we can go beyond that by artificially creating nuclei.
And it's the process of decay, of the loss of some... Now, what is shared, protons or neutrons?
It depends. Right. There are various modes of radioactive decay.
The loss of those, the shedding of those, is what is creating the radioactivity that comes from that element.
Yes, essentially, yes.
Is uranium the one with the largest atomic number that occurs in the environment naturally?
That occurs on Earth naturally, yes.
But in theory, these elements could occur in other places, in other environments beyond planet Earth naturally.
Yes, so in addition to the effort to synthesize heavier elements artificially, there's also been a search to look for them in trace amounts on Earth. Yes, in general, that's...
But that's intriguing. How could you find a trace of something if the element itself is
Pretty much in the same way Marie Curie did, as an impurity in something that's already known, but in very, very small amounts that's not detectable unless you're really looking for it, I suppose.
So you can assume, just as she thought, the uranium has come from something else, and I'll theorise it's this, and she was right. Or was it the other way around?
The uranium was already there. It was the radioactivity,
yes,
that she was following along. Yes. Yeah.
What was, apart from discovering these elements, what was her main contribution to the way we work as chemists now?
That's a good question. She, you know, depending on who you ask, she could be called a physicist or a chemist.
Yeah.
Radioactivity, obviously.
And you claim her as a chemist?
Seems to be physics. she won a Nobel Prize in chemistry, and I think that qualifies anyone to call themselves a chemist if they want to. Her PhD was in physics, of course. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff. So with radium, for example, they realised... They discovered polonium first, but radium was easier to isolate because it has a much longer half-life, a half-life of, I don't know, 1,300 years or so. And so they isolated significant amounts of it, and they were able to show that it could... So it was the first radiation therapy for cancer, that they could use it to burn off skin cancers and then healthy skin would grow back, which was probably why their work became so well known, because there were such immediate applications of it that people could see the value of. But then, of course, there's the dark side of that, which is that radium also, if ingested, and there were people who were painting on the faces of watch dials with luminous paint which contained radium in the 20s, and they'd lick the paintbrushes to keep the points nice and fine to write out the watch dials.
As you did.
And they were ingesting the radium. And because it's chemically very similar to calcium, which any chemist could tell you just based on its position in the periodic table, it replaces the calcium in your bones. And so a lot of the symptoms that are then caused are essentially bone cancer related.
Ah, so that's why radioactivity is in particular a threat to our bones,
well,
if we're exposed to it.
For this particular element, it gets into your bones, yes.
When Marie Curie was doing her work, was she aware that there was any health risk?
Not immediately, and I think it was probably quite hard for her to accept, even in the long run. Both Marie Curie and Pierre Curie had symptoms all the way through their work of what we would now call radiation poisoning. Marie Curie actually miscarried her second pregnancy, and this was exactly at the time that she was involved in her most significant efforts in isolating radium. So there are some historical factors that make it fairly clear that they were both affected. But having said that, she lived to the age of 67, I think, which is rather longer than the current life expectancy for a man born in Poland. So, you know, I would say you shouldn't sneer at radioactivity, but then again, she had a pretty good life.
I interviewed a woman, an American writer last year, Julie Desjardins, and she wrote a book called The Marie Curie Complex. And the basic idea of her book was that in order to get funding for her work, another American journalist actually encouraged her to publicise the altruistic nature of what she was doing, that radium was a healing thing and she was there to save humanity. And that worked in terms of getting money for her. But also the legacy of that puts a bit of pressure on women chemists who followed her, that you've kind of, to be accepted, this is her theory, and I'd be interested in your response to it, that you have to be altruistic. You can't be like a bloke and just want to be the best in the class.
Well, that's an interesting theory. I suppose, I mean, the history and the circumstances around that, I mean, Maria and Pierre Curie both refused to patent any of the work around the isolation of radium and polonium, even though they considered it seriously at one point, and they decided that they didn't believe that that was the right thing to do. And then in later life, after the death of Pierre Curie, Marie had to go to the United States to essentially fundraise and ask for donations to purchase a gram of radium so that she could continue her work.
Jardin's book was about, yeah.
So this is, you know, it's a difficult situation to imagine someone being put in, but I don't think it's specific to women in chemistry at all. I think the altruistic motives for doing science are quite real, and they are not to be sneezed at. I think they're good motivations for doing science, but it's not always the whole story, and the other aspects also need to be. You know, you need to be working in a reasonable framework.
Obviously, the lecture series, it's all women chemists, and it's in honour of Marie Curie. But is gender in any way relevant to your work as a chemist in New Zealand? Are there any barriers because you're a woman in your field?
I wouldn't say there are barriers exactly. I think women do just fine as chemists and as physicists and other kinds of scientists, actually. But there is a lot of research that shows the effect of stereotype on ourselves and on the way we behave and on what we consider ourselves equipped to do in life. And so, you know, there are good reasons why there are not as many women as men in science and in senior positions. So yes and no. Yeah.
Why did you choose to do chemistry?
Oh, because it's quite fun.
Yeah.
It's a bit like Lego.
You have to explain how.
Well, once you're quite familiar with the idea of atoms and that molecules are made of atoms and you can pull them apart and put them back together, and the comment's been made. I mean, I'm a theoretical chemist. I do most of my work computationally, but the comment's been made that chemistry is an experimental science and the most experimental of all sciences, even. And I think there is a reason for that, which is that, having had that experience of being in a lab and, you know, pulling molecules apart and creating different molecules and seeing colour changes and going from a solution of something colourless to crystals of a beautiful colour, or, you know, the sorts of transformations you can get by playing with atoms, that's, you know, it's wonderful fun, and it's quite transformational in the way that it changes your view of the world, I think. Afterwards, you can't really look at anything without wondering what it's made of.
I want to ask you for a definition of chemistry, because you mentioned physics earlier. What is the difference? What then is chemistry, if you were to define it in a sentence?
Chemistry is all about matter. It's about everything we touch and interact with, stuff. All the stuff that we deal with, atoms. There's not much that isn't chemistry in some sense. Physics sometimes deals with the same things, but it does so from a different perspective. chemistry is focused on the way things interact with each other and the way they react with each other and how to make new materials. And I suppose one of the things that's quite interesting is that so much of what we deal with is chemical. Well, everything is chemical. Everything is a chemical.
We're all chemicals, aren't we?
But the way they occur in nature tends to be mixed up in, you know, very complicated patterns which make leaves and air and the things that we interact with, whereas a chemist tends to isolate those in the lab in order to be able to study them more carefully, but they all exist in nature in principle.
What's your area of specialty at the moment at the McDiarmid Institute?
I do theoretical computational work on nanoparticles, materials, looking at surfaces that and the way that surfaces interact with molecules, for example, catalysis and how that works.
So catalysis, I don't know what that means.
So, for example, if you want to have a car that runs on hydrogen, for example, instead of gasoline, you would need to have a fuel cell in that car that converts, that is able to use the hydrogen as a fuel, and that relies on some sort of electric catalysis.
It's all right, it happens to me all the time.
Electrocatalyst.
Thank you, Brian.
And that would allow this reaction to happen because of the electronic properties of the material, which you have as the catalyst.
And there is probably right now a lot of interest again in that research, given the price of petrol.
Well,
going
yes,
back
I
over
think
$2.
An awful lot of energy research is related to materials in one way or another, and a lot of the most significant and powerful ways that we can tune the properties of materials and engineer them or tailor them for particular applications involves nanotechnology. So, you know, really looking at the atomistic scale, how we can design things.
I guess the trick is with that, the principle is that whatever energy you need to trigger the energy reaction that gets the car moving has to be small enough that the economics all stacks up.
Yes, the economics are very important, of course. And one of the issues with hydrogen is not just about getting the car moving, but how you transport the hydrogen, how you produce it in the first place. And that's all non-trivial, of course, but yeah.
Science and I think maybe especially chemistry has to deal with a bit of a, well, I think it's almost a backlash that you get in the popular press. And I think even back to the those ads, I don't know if you remember them, for butter. You remember those ads for butter? You might not be
I'm
old
not
enough.
I'm not sure, no.
It was all about it was the margarine versus butter, and the margarine guy was a scientist. He had a white coat.
Yes.
And he was well-meaning, but yes, it was fake. Mm. And the butter was natural and good.
Yes.
And I think that in pop culture is still a battle that chemists, perhaps more than any other field of science, have to deal with.
Well, there's that word chemical, right? And I talk about what the stuff that we're all made of, and it's chemicals, but I try not to use that word because it isn't received well by a lot of people. I read a very interesting article recently in The Guardian about MSG, of course, which a lot of people are quite concerned about if it's in their food. You know, monosodium glutamate, it's got this dreadful chemical name. It's
tastes good. Yeah.
Got an abbreviation. And the article was actually saying that, look, this occurs in a whole lot of foods, Parmesan cheese and walnuts and Marmite. And if you look at the ingredients of Marmite, actually, monosodium glutamate's in there. It's just under a different name. And it's naturally produced by the yeast. It's the yeast extract, if you like, and it's produced naturally in all sorts of conditions. But as soon as people are adding it to the food in the form of a white crystal, which is, you know, a chemical, suddenly people aren't so happy with it anymore. And I think it strikes at the heart of what a lot of chemists know. The moment you go into a chemistry lab and you do an experiment, you have to look up the toxicity data on your compounds that you're going to be working with. And, you know, it's amazing. I think, I'm not entirely sure, and someone may correct me on this, but I believe that there are only three chemicals which are known to not be carcinogenic. There are a bunch that are known to be carcinogenic, and then everything else is suspected
everything
to be carcinogenic. So everything.
Causes cancer.
Yeah. And all it is that it just depends on the dose.
Mm.
You know, if a small amount of something in the right context is fine, and salt, you know, regular sodium chloride and monosodium glutamate, probably not so different. Perhaps the dose that you should have to enjoy a meal or to eat healthily is different in each case, but fundamentally there's no significant difference.
How do you deal with that then? Is that a battle that's worth fighting? Because perhaps one of the reasons it happens is because what you do from the point of view of somebody who doesn't understand chemistry, and I'll lump myself in that, seems to involve so much brain power that we just can't get there. So in the end, we almost give up, and then it becomes a matter of trust, and people come along who are natural, from the natural world and natural healing, and we trust them more.
It's funny that you say that, because brain power, I don't know. I mean, a first-year chemistry student at university gets to make aspirin, right, in a chemistry lab. A lot of it's not that hard. And having had the experience and having been able to use the tools where you see that you're converting one molecule into another, I think that information, that understanding about the way that you can manipulate atoms and rearrange matter, it's incredibly valuable. And I think a lot of people need to be exposed to those concepts a little bit more, because it's fabulous in terms of just being able to turn around and look at the world and say, well, you know, I know what that's made of, or the experiment where somebody took some blood and dried a concentrated sample of blood and then was able to manipulate it with a magnet, because it contains iron, right? And being able to show that your blood contains iron and the implications of that, having fun with that idea, it's rather nice, I think.
Is there an onus on scientists to become better communicators?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's understood more and more. It's interesting for me, because I worked in Germany for a few years after I did my PhD, and they have quite a lot more social acceptance of science, and part of that might be because they have things like a large chemical industry, etc.
Do you think it's also the education system there?
It's perhaps also the education system, but it's definitely something that's cultural. They have open days at scientific institutes, and people take their 3-year-olds along to play with, you know, models of molecules and watch the robots play soccer and things like this. So, yeah, I think culturally we have a long way to go in our acceptance of science, and some of that, I don't know, sometimes I wonder if it has something to do with the myth of number 8 wire and the fact that innovation's just, you know, playing around with stuff in your garage rather than thinking about things scientifically.
Innovation also involves hard work though, doesn't it? If you really want to be good at as a chemist, you have to work hard.
You have to work hard and you have to be creative. You have to think about things that people haven't thought about before. There's a base of knowledge which you need to start with, I would argue.
Will there be some open days around New Zealand as part of the chemistry year?
I haven't heard about anything along those lines, actually.
There's still time.
There is still time. I know some of the universities have open days periodically, typically for potential students to come along and look at the departments, etc. But yeah.
Nicola, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Nicola Gaston from the McDiarmid Institute for Advanced Materials and Nanotechnology. She will be back with more chemistry in the middle of next month.